it's me, but I'm not Patsy, I'm Bria, filling in for Joy on Paper. And we have just had a wonderful interview with author Carol Stivers. Next, we've got our second guest for the afternoon. And before we bring him in, I've got a book buzz, a science fiction book buzz that I had the privilege of doing for his book. And we're going to listen to that, and then you'll get to meet the author and hear all more about the book. And Big Ed, go for it. Hello, fellow sci-fi readers. This is author Bria Burton reporting for Joy on Paper with your science fiction book buzz. Today's communique to galaxies near and far includes a 2022 series starter, Mickey 7 by Edward Ashton. The novel is available in print, ebook, and audiobook, with stellar narration by John Pirala. Soon to be a major motion picture called Mickey 17, starring Robert Pattinson. Now, let's download the book buzz. Every time Mickey dies, his body is remade and his uploaded conscience is downloaded into the next iteration, currently Mickey 7. As the ship's expendable, all life-threatening tasks get assigned to him. Multiples are forbidden. When he survives a fall into an icy crevasse thanks to the alien worm that carries him to safety, a shipmate had already reported him dead. Back in his room, Mickey 7 encounters Mickey 8, fresh out of the tank. Neither wants to dive back into the recycler, but can they pull off living as multiples? How hard can it be? Maybe it will make life easier for both of them. That is, until the daily rations get cut in half and Mickey's girlfriend starts to suspect something. A darkly humorous romp full of existential queries about the meaning of life, death, cloning, and immortality, Mickey 7 launches readers into a new page-turning sci-fi series with a sequel on the way. Author Edward Ashton has two other novels and over 24 short fiction pieces published. He writes in a cabin in the woods in upstate New York. This is Bria Burton with your futuristic fiction fix, signing off. That's a little bit about the book. And do we have Edward Ashton here on the radio? Edward, can you hear me?
I can, and I want to thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, it is a pleasure. I am so glad that you could join us today. And I am very excited to talk about your book. So we're going to get right into it. Mickey 7, tell us a little bit about the idea. What prompted you to take a character and kill him over and over and over?
I mean, that's an easy one. I'm an author, and there aren't
sadists. Yep.
So they always tell you in a creative writing class, first thing they say is you come up with a character, and then you find out how you're going to get him into trouble. This was the worst sort of trouble I could come up with. So that's sort of where I wound up with the concept for the expendable.
Yes, and the expendable. So that is Mickey, that's his position on board this spaceship, and they are going out to deep space to essentially tell us a little bit about the idea that, okay, Earth is now virtually uninhabitable. It sounds like in the book there's still maybe some people there, but for the most part, there's this diaspora going out into the galaxy. And does each ship have an expendable, or is it just the ship that Mickey's on?
The expendable is in this universe is a recent invention. Mm-hmm. The original colony missions did not have them.
Okay.
More recent ones do. Ordinarily, the expendable is a convict or someone who's been forced into the job. Mickey is very unique in that he actually volunteered for the job.
Yes, there is this wonderful scene where the recruiter is basically trying to talk Mickey out of it and say, like, dude, you really don't want this job. And that's one of the things I loved about your book. It has a lot of this wonderfully dark humor. Tell me a little bit about how did you go about sprinkling those moments in? Did it come very organically, or did you work really hard to try to get those little humorous bits throughout?
I actually worked really hard to tone it down. I'm naturally just a very sarcastic person. And so if you look at a first draft of any of my books, there's tons of dialogue where people are going back and forth and bantering, and sometimes that sort of banter occurs in places that are emotionally inappropriate. So one of the first editing, my editing path process is very regimented because I'm an engineer. I like to do things by process. And one of the processing passes is to go through and look for places where people are being smart asses and they shouldn't, where it's completely inappropriate for them to do it. And so I would say there's probably only 20% as much snark left in the book as there was in the first draft.
That's a great word, the snark. Yes, that's a good word. That well describes a lot of the humor throughout. And I just wanted to share with you, I thought you had a wonderful opening line. This is something, as writers, if there's any writers out there listening, that opening line, that opening paragraph can be so elusive to try to get that really, the one that really hooks the reader. And your opening line in this book, I thought, was a beautiful hook. And it says, "This is going to be my stupidest death ever." And it was, the snark is there, the intrigue. Okay, so this character has multiple deaths. What does that mean? And you get into it and you see just where Mickey has gotten himself into. And I just thought, oh, what a great first line. And you talk about your process. Was the first line something that was with you at the beginning, or did that develop later as you were editing the book?
That specific line, "This is going to be my stupidest death ever," in the first draft, was actually about two paragraphs down. And I was workshopping the book with a group of other authors that train manuscripts with, and I have to give credit to my friend Craig Delancey. He saw that and he said, "You've got to move that up to the top. That's got to be your first line." And he was, I actually fought him on it a little bit in the discussion, but he was absolutely right.
Oh my goodness, what a wonderful writing friend who could give you that insight. And speaking of critique groups, this is something that writers here at Joy on Paper, I know the host Patsy is often talking to writers about the need for other people to get their eyes on your work to help you develop and strengthen your craft. How did you find your writing partners and the people that take a look at your work? And I take it you return the favor and take a look at theirs as well.
Yeah, I've got, again, two different groups of people who do my first reading. The first are basically family and friends. They don't have any particular expertise as writers or anything else, but they can tell me if I've gone off the rails on something, which I find really valuable. Once it's gotten through their filters, I have a group of other writers that I've connected with here in the Western New York area. I actually hooked up with them because one of them heard one of my stories on a podcast called Escape Pod, and he reached out to me and said, "Hey, I really like your work. We have this group. We meet once a month, and we exchange manuscripts and talk about our work, and we'd really like you to join." And that was, I guess, 7 or 8 years ago, and I've been meeting with them ever since, and we've gotten to be really good friends, and they've been immensely helpful to my work.
Oh, that's so wonderful. What a great man. I don't know how many writers get people reaching out saying, "I heard your work on a podcast and I want you in my group." That's what a neat thing to have happen. And I am familiar with Escape Pod. It's one of the science fiction branches of the Podcastle, Escape Pod, and Pseudopod are the three escape artists, as far as I'm remembering. And they do these wonderful podcasts with fiction stories. And so you had your story produced by one of those podcasts. I bet that was very neat to hear someone reading your story on a podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a number of stories on podcasts of one sort or another. I've had two with Escape Pod. They also have a fourth one, which is Cat's Cast, and which is all cat-related stories. I haven't submitted anything to them yet. I'm not really into the cat fiction.
Oh, genre, yes, so. Interesting. They have an exclusive cat podcast. That's hilarious.
They do, yeah. It actually started as an April Fool's joke. that they were launching this Cats cast, and they actually had a commissioned story that they read for it, and people liked it so much that they made it an actual part of their lineup. So.
You know, there really is a place for every writer. If you're writing cat stories, I hope you're listening, and now you know where you can submit your stories about cats. So tell us a little bit about this book. Is the first book in a series that you're writing, correct?
That's a bit of a difficult question. It wasn't sold to my publisher as a series.
Ah.
It was sold as a standalone book. But I always try to leave a little opening at the end of everything that I write to build more. Because the way that the publishers look at things is that they assume that in a series, the sales of each subsequent book will be a fraction of the sales of the previous book.
So
if you go to them and pitch a four-book series, and the first book doesn't do as well as they expected, or even if it does reasonably well but just not outstandingly, they're likely to cut that series short.
Okay.
And I never wanted to leave my readers hanging with an unfinished story. So I every one of my books is a standalone story, but they are sometimes connected. And lead one to the next. So right now, Antimatter Blues is a sequel to Mickey 7. That's the second book in the series, if you want to call it that. Again, if you finish that book, you'll see I've left myself an opening. I've completed the story. It's completely wrapped up, but there is a possibility that more could be done here. And whether more is going to be done here or not is going to depend on what my publisher, my editors think about how that book performs.
As you say that, it resonates very much with me, having read the book. It is a very complete story. You get the full arc of this character as he discovers what it means when he meets his clone and decides, I don't want to go in the recycler. And it's such a funny moment, and I don't want to spoil it, but there are just these wonderful little antics that happen throughout the book. And by the end, there is that complete story, and we see where the character is growing and learning through this process. And the world building that you have, I just thought you did such an incredible job. Can you just expand a little bit on decisions that you made for what made it into the novel, and maybe what did you write that you thought, well, I as the author need to know all these things about this universe that I've created, but only a little bit can get in the novel. Do you know what I'm referring to in that idea of when you're world building, not everything gets in the novel, but it's something that might show up in a later book?
Yeah, absolutely. And world building is a unique part of science fiction and fantasy writing. You know, if you write a book that's set in contemporary Manhattan, you don't need to do world building. You just mention, the site of the Empire State Building, and everyone knows exactly where you are and exactly what the setting is and what the sort of rules and the mores are of the culture. When you're writing something that's set 1,000 years in the past or 1,000 years in the future, you can't do that. You have to actually paint a picture for the reader of what the world is, what things look like, how technology works now, how people interact now, probably social mores and customs are different. And you can't just lay that out. You can't just start with, you know, a chapter where you describe everything about how the world works. That's an info dump, and nobody wants to read that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you have to find ways to sort of subtly work into the manuscript clues to the reader to pick up on how things work here and what's going on. And the way that I did that in this book was I made my protagonist a historian, and I had him sort of obsess over various aspects of his culture's history, and in that way I'm able to present him to the reader, hopefully in an entertaining way.
Oh, very much so. And that, what a neat choice to have him be this history buff who is very interested in where humanity came before his time. So that when he's thinking about those things, it makes sense to the story. It doesn't feel like the author is intruding and just throwing all this info at the reader that they don't actually need to move the story forward. I thought you did that beautifully. And talk a little bit about, for example, his good buddy, who they have this, so his friend Berto, they have this very interesting relationship where they're friends, but there's almost this antagonistic element to their friendship, especially at the beginning when we do find out Berto is responsible for part of Mickey's problems, which leads to this Mickey 8 coming up out of the tank before Mickey 7 actually is dead, and the whole idea of cloning and all that. So Berto, that character, at one point is doing, he's this very kind of macho man, and he does this sporting competition. How did you come up with the sporting competition that he did, and that ends up being a little bit of a flashback, but it's so effective?
Yeah, I based the character of Berto loosely on someone that I actually knew when I was younger, and I'm still friends with. And I've mentioned to him that he was the basis of this character. I don't know that he's particularly happy with me about that.
So
probably send out an apology to him now if he's listening. But there are some people who just are good at everything they try. You meet these people occasionally, and he's one of them.
Yes.
You know, this is a guy who, you know, the real life person is someone who just decided he wanted to try out for a Division I basketball team in college and made the team.
Oh, yeah.
you shouldn't be able to do that. That's not something that a human should be able to do, but he's able to do these things. And that sort of person can be great to hang around with, and also can be really annoying to hang around with. And I try to capture that sort of dynamic. And there's also a little bit of a big brother, little brother relationship between Berto and Mickey, particularly at the beginning of the book, that I wanted to play off of as well.
Yes, and just to go back to modeling characters on real people. So often, writers who, for example, might use a pen name, or they don't want their family to know they're writing these books because, oh, I don't know, the family member might look and say, is that supposed to be me? I love that you just went ahead and told your friend, okay, this character is based on you, and then had to kind of deal with the repercussions of that, because as we create characters, as authors, the real life examples that are modeled for us by having relationships with people, that tends to make a story richer. And I think your example that you just gave was such a wonderful example of, here is a type of person, and it's not even that your friend is entirely this Berto character, but that type of person who can just go pick up a basketball and suddenly they're the star player, even though they didn't grow up playing, that type of thing. And that's something people can look at and say, oh, I know somebody like that. And so much of your story, I thought, had all those little relatable elements to characters, and excellent job with those characterizations. So let's go back to the cloning. Tell us a little bit about the cloning, and what is it that that gave you the idea that, okay, this expendable is going to be the only one who gets to be cloned, but he's not allowed to have multiples. You set these rules, which is a wonderful thing to do in a story, to set these rules that shouldn't be broken, and then you go ahead and break them, and that's really the impetus for the story. Can you talk a little bit about the idea of the cloning and where all that it came from and where you wanted it to go?
Well, the idea of the cloning actually is something that's been a little bit of an obsession of mine ever since I was young. And it really comes back to a philosophical problem that goes back to the 1700s, which is, it's called the teletransport paradox. It was originally formulated as a letter to the English Royal Society, where the question was, if I could copy, at that time they were talking about souls, if I could copy my soul into a new body that was exactly like mine in every way, would that person be me, or would this be a new person? And so the place where you've seen that in modern culture is the transporter beam in Star Trek.
Mm,
right? So you step on the transporter beam, and it sort of scans the position of every atom in your body or whatever it does and transmits the information someplace else, and then they rebuild you on the other end. And the question is, has that person been transported or has that person been killed?
Hmm.
And just a new person who thinks he's him and looks like him and acts like him is now running around on this other planet. And this is an idea that other writers have played around with.
Yes.
There's a very famous story called Think Like a Dinosaur, for instance, that hits this topic much more sort of like nail on the head. But that's a question that I have thought about a lot in different ways, and I've explored it in some of my short fiction as well as, you know, obviously looking at it in Mickey 7. And honestly, I still don't know where I land on it. Would I get onto that transporter pad or not? Yeah. I don't know.
It's quite a dilemma to think. If this means I'm about to be killed, but then I'll wake up thinking I haven't been. Yeah. Quite a dilemma if that were a reality, a choice we had to make. And you talk about the ship of Theseus in the book.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously another, that's a much older philosophical question. That goes back to Plutarch. That's one that's also been explored in various places. But the basic idea there is that you have a ship, it's sailing around the world, and as it sails, it gets damaged, it loses individual boards, spars, lines, they all have to be replaced. By the time it gets back, every single piece of the ship has been replaced, and is it the same ship?
Right.
And as it turns out, this is a really tight analogy for human life because, you know, you and I sitting here, there's not a single cell in our bodies that was part of our bodies 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We've been complete with this sort of colony organism that is us, this group of cells, is made up of completely different individual cells than it was 15 years ago.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful philosophical questions that science fiction, oh, is just so rife with. This is one of the reasons I love reading it. And the big news that I could not wait to ask you about, there is a film coming called Mickey 17 featuring, I believe, Robert Pattinson has been cast as the lead. Is that correct?
Yep. Mark Ruffalo is going to be in, Naomi Ackie.
Oh my goodness.
Holiday Granger, it's a really nice cast.
What an exciting development. And what is the name change? So your book, Mickey 7, as a film, is going to be called Mickey 17. Do you have any kind of input when they take your book and say, we want to make it a movie? Or is it, we are now in charge and you have no say in any of this? Tell us a little bit about that.
Once they option your book, you really don't have any say in what they do with it. They bought rights. They can do pretty much anything they want. Now, in this particular case, the director is Bong Joon-ho, who is an absolutely wonderful person, and I've gotten the opportunity to speak with him a number of times now. And when he first got involved with the project, he called me, and we spoke for about 2 hours. And just talked about different aspects of the book. He asked me a bunch of questions about, like, how do creepers reproduce?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's when a mommy creeper and her daddy creeper love each other very much, I guess. I don't know. but he actually asked me if there was something in the book that I felt needed to be in the movie. Because when you go from a book to a movie, you lose things necessarily. You're going from a 350-page novel to a 120-page script, and things are going to have to come out. And he said, I want you to tell me the one thing that you feel is the heart of this book, and I will promise you that it will be in the film. And he didn't have to do that by any stretch, but he did it. And so I said,
wow, that's
so neat. I had to
think
about it for about 2 seconds, and I said, chapter 19. I want chapter 19 to be in the film. And he said, oh, that's fantastic. That actually, I cried when I read that chapter. I was going to put that in there anyway. And I said, can I get another one? And he said, no.
It didn't hurt to ask, though, right?
It never hurts to try. Never hurts to try. But the point is, he didn't have to do that. He made that allowance for me, and I really appreciate it, and I'm very, very grateful.
Well, what an incredible thing. You got 2 hours to just talk to this director who's going to be taking your book and turn it into film. And did he tell you why he named it Mickey 17?
He just liked murder. He didn't feel like I was murderous enough, and he wanted to murder some more.
Okay, so just to give the Mickey 7 is actually the seventh Mickey. So we've got Mickey 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and in the story we start with Mickey 7. So he wants there to be a lot more Mickeys before...
Yeah.
Okay, so it's just a matter of a lot more deaths are going to be happening. Well, we do have to wrap up, but this has been absolutely wonderful to talk to you. I'm looking at the Ed Fort right now, your website, and tell us, it is edwardashton.com is where people can find you and learn more about your books and where to buy them?
That's it. All the buy links are there, all my short stories, pretty much everything you'd want to know about me.
Wonderful. Edwardashton.com, and you can even see a preview of Antimatter Blues, a Mickey 7 novel. When does that release?
That comes out in March, March 23rd in the U.S., I believe.
Wonderful. Go ahead and get your copy, listener, of Mickey 7 so that when the sequel comes, you'll be ready. And it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you, Edward.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye now. And this is Bria Burton. If you want to know more about me, go to my website, briaburton.com, and you can find out all about my writing and what's going on. Thank you, listeners, and go out there and get writing.